Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We are brought to you by the Tough Man Triathlon Series, by Oska Wellness, the coolest new product in pain relief. RunCatalina.com, the Catalina Marathon, a 40th anniversary, coming up on Saturday, March 11th. Our Challenge Athletes Foundation, we've raised over $80 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check us out on Babbittville.com, on iTunes. Subscribe to our newsletter. Our next guest, he won his second straight Ironman Arizona in a row. And more importantly, 7:44:29, breaking not only the course record, but it was the fastest Ironman in history. Mr. Lionel Sanders joins us. Lionel, has that sunk in, the fastest in history?
I'll be honest with you, it hasn't. I love this sport, and I've been following it, you know, since I got into it in 2010, and I definitely have been very well aware of, you know, when Marino set that time in 2011. And so, you know, to actually go faster than that time, yeah, it's a bit surreal for me. It's amazing. I don't know what else to say.
Well, what's interesting to me is when we chatted early in the season, it was all eggs in the basket for 70.3 Mooloolaba. I'm going for the world championship there. That's what I'm training for. And then I'll worry about Kona afterwards. And that was really your approach, right? You kept your bike rides 2 hours-ish, didn't really run more than 20K or so, and it was all about Mooloolaba. And so the build-up to Mooloolaba, you felt ready?
Yeah, I mean, I stuck to that plan. I said if I'm going to go all the way to Australia, it was like 25 hours of travel for me from here in Canada. I said, if I'm going to go all that way, then I'm putting all the eggs in that basket. And so that's what I did. And I just pretended like Kona didn't even exist, and I did nothing to prepare whatsoever for Kona. And yeah, I mean, I got to Mooloolaba, and I had probably the best performance of my entire life up until that point. I pushed, you know, I had a great swim, but my least deficit to the front. I pushed the highest bike power average I had ever pushed on the bike for 90K, and then I was able to hold 320 per kilometer off the bike, which is probably my best run off the bike that I'd ever done as well. So from a performance standpoint, you know, I hit exactly what I had dreamed of hitting. Unfortunately, you know, I had an Ironman a month later, and, you know, I probably with hindsight now, I shouldn't have even started Kona. It was kind of disrespectful, quite frankly, to the sport, because I thought, oh, you know, I've got my top end system in really good shape.
Right.
Maybe I can gut out double the distance at the World Championship. And the reality was that I could not do it. The conditions are just far too extreme, you know, with the wind, the heat, the saltwater swim, non-wetsuit swim. It just all that added together, plus having not done, you know, pretty much close to very little actual, you know, longer volume. I physically, my body said, at about 6 hours into that race, my body said, enough is enough. I'm quitting on you. Sorry. And that made for a very, very, very painful final, you know, basically over half of the marathon, I was walk jogging, and it was excruciatingly painful to walk jog.
Well, and you know what, but if you look back at the history, you look at Pauly Kirui, you look at some of the great athletes who, you know, when you come to Kona, for a lot of pros, thinking that I'm not having my day, I'm not going to make any money, I'm not going to be in the top 10, I'm not going to get a lot of points, they cut the cord, right? They go, okay, I'll go get ready for Ironman Arizona. But I've seen over time a Pauly Kirui, I think someone like yourself, there's a lot of respect for Kona. It's like, listen, you know, I can still move. So I'm not going to just quit here. I'm going to get to the finish line. It won't be my best, but I owe it to the sport and to the event to get to the finish line.
I believe that's disrespectful, quite frankly. And I mean, that's no offense to people who make that decision or anything.
Sure.
But I think it's disrespectful because, I mean, you know, first of all, you take away from the glory of the guys who are having a good day.
Yes.
By doing that, you don't feel. I mean, I learned this lesson from Sebastian Kienle. You don't feel defeat. And you want to feel that defeat. That defeat is what makes you stronger for the later date. And then as well, just the history of the sport, how many people, you see people literally crawling to the finish. Those are like the iconic, you know, reasons yes. why we love Ironman. And so I certainly, from the beginning, have been of the mindset that you either get to that finish line, you know, in any way you can, walk or crawl or whatever, or you go home in the ambulance, you go home on the stretcher because you physically could not go any further. And so, you know, I certainly it would have taken basically that for me to not have finished in Kona.
When I look at Mooloolaba, the 70.3 Worlds, and I see, you know, you swam, I think, 25:41. Sebi swam 24:14. But everybody else in that top 10 was between 22:40 and 22:53. And mm-hmm. then everybody, and you know how you ride the bike. But everybody in that top 10 was, besides Sebi, who I think rode 204 or something, but you guys all rode 206, right? Everybody mm-hmm. rode the same. That had to be frustrating for you, knowing how much power you were putting out. Was it the type of thing where you're going, oh, my God, I'm not making up any ground here?
Yeah, I mean, it was disappointing. And in the moment, you're not very good at sort of ascertaining, you know, what the root causes are of that sort
right.
of thing. But with hindsight, most definitely, and I'm not gonna point fingers at anyone
right.
or anything, but there certainly is an issue either due to the subjectivity of the drafting zone or due to the fact that it was a very flat beginning 60 kilometers or so of the course
yep.
with very high speeds, very light winds, in which case a 10-meter draft zone is not enough because, you know, I have been used to pushing, well, less power in riding, you know, 3-4. This is what has allowed me to even make this into a career because I was able to ride 3 or 4 minutes into some of these guys. And
yep.
so in this race, you know, I actually got outbiked by 15. Well, I think actually it ended up being like 16 or 17 people if you count Sebastian Kienle and Andreas Dries.
Yes.
And I it was an experience that I definitely was not used to. So. But I think it's a testament that I still am doing this for the right reasons because I said, okay, you know, whatever, this is not going as planned. I'm still going to pound this run out as hard as I possibly can, regardless of if it's not going to plan, because, you know, this is how the day unfolded. And, you know, I did take pride in the fact that I still was able to have, you know, probably the best run of my career off the bike.
Well, 1:10:34, you finished ninth with a phenomenal day, right? So you come back from that. And like you said, we talked last year, it was, you know what, I went to Kona right from 70.3 Worlds. I was there 3 weeks or a month, and just it was almost too much. You just got too comfortable, and I need to be
yeah.
in my training zone, and then I'll come a little later this year. And so this
yeah.
year you came a little later. Do you think that played into it at all, or was it just more along the lines of, you know, I really didn't do the volume of training I needed to do?
Yeah, I mean, if anything, I'd say I was in a better mindset this time around.
Yeah, you definitely were.
I'll definitely liked. Last year I was there 3 weeks in advance of the race. And, you know, I'm the type of guy who becomes sort of one with the environment. And, you know, just being in sort of that kind of beach community and
yeah.
stuff, for me, I was, you know, definitely being like, okay, I think I'm going to go buy a surfboard, and I think I'm going to start just be a surf bum, and so that's sort of the mindset that I had started the Kona 2015 in, and I just for me anyway, that's not how I race my best. I need to be angry. I need to be fired up. So this time I came a week in advance, and I definitely was angry. I definitely was fired up to have a good race, and I won't change that definitely in the future, but. You know, and even in the race, I had my best swim in Kona. I was 2 minutes faster than I was the year previous, 2 minutes closer to the front. And then on the bike, I actually, by almost the Javi turnaround, I was only less than 2 minutes down to the front. Like, I could hear the helicopter overhead. It was like all things I've been dreaming of, you know. So it certainly wasn't a lack of motivation, because I had a ton of motivation. But at about 120 kilometers into the bike ride, which, you know, if you're training for a 70.3 and you're able to go 120K, I'd say that's pretty good.
Yep.
My body that was the point where my legs said, no, sorry, enough is enough. And it just became so difficult to do that final 60 kilometers. And then by the time I got off the bike, that was it. Like, I couldn't even fathom running a marathon off of it. And I said, this is going to be a long day. And then, you know, coming up, what is it?
Pilani.
Yeah. Yeah, that was like the nail in the coffin. And by the time I got to the top of that hill, it was the wheels had completely fallen off, and it was a walk jog from then on. And that's a long way to walk jog through with no cheering crowds really or anything.
Nothing.
It's, and so it literally was 14 or so aid stations. Of every aid station, coming up to it and going away from it was this internal battle of, okay, I think I'm dropping out now. I think I'm dropping out. This is it. This is ridiculous. I think I'm dropping out. And yeah, I mean, it was a day that I will never forget, and not for good reasons.
Well, you learn stuff from that when you have those type of days, and then you're able to turn it around and go to the Bahamas, Island House Triathlon. And what's cool about that event, only top 20 men and women in the world, and the top 10 make the final day, and you made the final day, which was really cool. And totally different style of racing, right? You're racing against people you've read about, some of these ITU athletes, but you've never really raced them before. And it's sort of what's great about it, you're on a TT bike, right? But at the same time, it's a lot of bike handling because there's a lot of turns and things along that line. I'm betting that you really enjoyed that because it was full out, but it was short and just different than anything you've done before.
I to be honest with you, I was dreading going to the race because I was like, you know, I know the proportions that the Olympic distance, the swim makes up a much larger portion of the race.
Yes.
So I was like, oh God, like I'm at such a disadvantage. And then, you know, the short distance component, of course, you know, we're training for the longer distance up. So I was dreading going to it because I was thinking this is going to be so embarrassing for me. But then when I got there, that was the most fun I have ever had in a race situation. Like, the guys were great. Everyone was great. It was so great to have, we had these social gatherings and everything with these ITU guys that I probably will never, from at least in ITU races, have the opportunity to race. And so just to connect with them and then, of course, to observe in real life, just the amazing swimming these guys are doing, the amazing biking and running they're doing. It was just, everything was an amazing experience. So, the moment I got there, I was like, oh, wow, this was a great decision to come to here. Even if I don't make the final day, don't make any money or anything, this was totally worth coming to. And now, because in that race, I found out at the briefing in the beginning that if you had the fastest swim, bike, or run, or if you went top five, you got an auto invite to next year. And I saw I was biking well on the first day. So I thought, all right, well, maybe I can try and go for the fastest bike and try and get myself invited back to this thing next year.
Yep.
So I ended up getting the fastest bike over the course of the weekend. And so now, next year, I'm going to make that a really big focus, that race, because I think it's just such a great test. It's so much out of my comfort zone. And it'll be a great benchmark for my swimming to see if I'm truly improving my swimming this year, which is what I really want to focus on, because these guys literally are the best in the world. They're pushing the swim so far.
Well, and what was fun to watch on the second day, the equalizer or whatever the heck they called it.
The Enduro.
Swim, run, swim 750, run 5K, ride 40K, which I'm sure you're excited about. Then jumping back in the water and trying not to drown. With 750, and then the 5K run. I mean, I'm sitting there going, oh, my God, this is brutal. You guys had a problem just getting out of the water.
It was crazy. Like that, I'd never done that before, done a hard bike ride and then swam after. And, like literally guys were like, I'm thinking of myself because, like, I'm the weak swimmer here.
Yes.
And I'm like, I mean, there's probably shark in these waters, and I'm the weak guy of the herd. Like, I'm the one they're going to attack here.
Right,
so,
right.
These are the thoughts that are starting to cross my mind because literally I get into the water and I can feel my quads starting to lock up because you go from like constant power, constant pushing down on the pedals, and all of a sudden the leg is just kind of floating there and your muscles are kind of floating around in the water. And like it was probably 50% of the guys, literally their legs were cramping up in the water. And like I remember Mario literally had to sit down on the beach because his legs were cramping so badly. And so it just was it was fun. In some twisted way, it was fun, this new experience to go from riding hard to swimming hard, then back to running hard. It was cool. It was fun. If you like that kind of stuff, it was fun.
Well, it was fun, and then you ended up making the final day, getting 10K. That's pretty sweet, right?
Totally, yeah. I mean, that was all just icing on the cake, making the final day and making a couple bucks. But it paid far more than money could give you in terms of the experience. Like, I'll never forget when I got to see Richard Murray run and see all these guys, these ITU guys swimming in real life and stack myself up and see, you know, in some cases I did well, and in other cases, like the swim, I'm like, you know, miles behind. So it was very, very motivating for me.
So what I love is how things can turn around. You look at Kona, you were 29th, right? And then Brett McMahon, fellow Canadian, he was 30th, right, in Kona. And then you guys go to Arizona where, you know, you're the defending champion. Brent has gone sub-8 there, and everything turns around. Talk about your day in Arizona, because that's one of those when I interview folks and ask them about those type of days, they just go, I felt like it was easy, right? I know towards the end of that run, it didn't feel like it was easy, but a 53-minute swim, and did you just feel like, you know what, I'm just feeling good today?
Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, what I got out of Kona, the analysis I did was that I hadn't done enough volume, so I knew I had the speed, so I knew. You know, I got 6 weeks basically to put in some volume. And my theory was that it doesn't take much. In fact, you don't want to do too much volume because then you get so tired you can't really push the top end stuff. So I basically did 5 weeks of pretty high volume work. I got in 3 5-hour bike rides, a 40K run, a 35K run, probably like 4 or 5 30K runs, all in this 5 week period. So by the end of that 5 week period, I was starting to, like, I did a 5 hour ride to a 1 hour bike or a 1 hour run off of it, and I actually had no lull in the 5 hours, and I felt pretty good on the run. I think I was like 3:55 per kilometer or something for the run, and it felt, you know, fairly easy. And so that was sort of the big change that I made leading into the race. So I started to think, you know what, I think I might be able to put together a good race. I had a good race at 70.3 Worlds from like a physiological standpoint. And so now that I'm starting to get the endurance and I got the top end speed, I think I can have a good race here. So, and another big thing that I both started to learn a bit more about at Island House, as well as, you know, something that people have sort of been advising me, is from a relaxation standpoint in the water, I've been trying to swim like I run, which is, you know, put a ton of effort forth. And the reality is, you know, effort is good if you have good technique. To put that effort forth, you know, through. And I just, as the moment I start to really up the effort in the swim, my technique really deteriorates. So in the water, I really strive to not put that much effort forth. It sounds weird to say it, and really focus on adopting better form and holding that form. And that's all I did in the swim. And it probably is one of the easiest swims I've ever done. And yet I came out with guys who were 4 minutes ahead of me in Kona just 6 weeks prior. So, you know, that kind of really set the day up really, really well for me. And then on the bike, once again, as you say, it was one of those days on the bike where I actually thought my power meter was malfunctioning because I was pushing like 325 watts, and literally it felt like it was, you know, easy pace.
Right.
And so, you know, I basically had to really force myself to keep the power low, or rather, you know, within those
sure.
Those, what do you say,
the margins. Parameters, yeah.
Yeah, and but then around, you know, 3 hours, 5 weeks of endurance training was good, and it certainly got me to ride much better, but I really started to feel it around 3 hours, and by 3.5, you know, I had to make that decision. Am I going to bury myself to really try and keep this power up, or am I going to, you know, reduce the power? And so I did reduce the power to about 270 watts for the final 35 minutes or so. So I did average 315 watts for the entirety of the bike, which is a new best power output for an Ironman bike. So I had my best swim ever, my best bike ever. And then, you know, coming out onto the run course, I noticed just out of the corner of my eye, the clock said 5:01 and some change.
Yeah.
And I started doing the math. I knew Marino's time was 7:45 and some change. And I said, all right, if you can do a sub-2:44 marathon, you might have a shot at it. And so, you know, that sort of became, you know, it was tucked away in the back of my mind. And I Well, I knew once again that I wasn't going to have the legs. 5 weeks of endurance training was good, but it wasn't going to be enough to go the full marathon. So I started to really build up the fat, I guess, on the first half of the run, and I think I went through the first half at about 118 high, 119 low, something.
Yeah.
So I knew I had a bit of fat going on to the second, but, man, at mile 17, I started to hurt so bad. And that's when I said, not possible. You're not going to be under Marino's time. So you know, don't worry about it. Just stop looking at the watch. And
your fiance changed all that.
Well, then, yes. Usually she's just waiting for me at the finish line,
yeah.
Right? So I think that's really what took me aback is all of a sudden I come into mile 23 and there's Aaron.
Yeah.
And she's like, you can still, you're still on pace if you want it. You can still break the time if you want it. And I usually, you know, when I'm out like that, I say to her, no, babe, sorry, I don't got it today, you know, this negative stuff. But today, for some reason, I didn't say anything. I just kept running. And, it was like reverberating around in the back of my head. And I come through the aid stations, one of the aid stations, and I got a nice ice-cold glass of water. And the water hit the back of my throat. And for some reason, all of a sudden, it's just like I woke up. And all of a sudden, I was like, it's now or never. Like, you're going to regret this so bad if you don't go for it now. And it just shows how much of this stuff is in your mind.
Exactly.
And how much of it truly is a limitation. And, you know, I probably picked up the pace like 2 seconds per mile, something, you know, tiny. Yet it felt like I had picked it up so much. And I kept picking up. And I actually started to yell at myself out loud. Like I was doing anything I could to motivate myself. And I started yelling, come on, come on. And people, I can see out of the corner of my eye, people on the race course are like thinking I'm insane or something like that. But whatever, I had to do what I had to do. And I actually ended up getting the pace back down to 6 minute mile pace. And I was able to close out those final 2 miles or so in about 6 minutes per mile. And then I came around the final corner and I saw the clock still said 7:44 and was counting up. And I knew, okay, I think we're going to go under the time. And I grabbed a Canadian flag from someone and, you know, flew it proudly,
and
it was an amazing experience. And of course, I've been staring at this picture of Craig Alexander for the longest time of him winning Kona 2009. It was the first time I'd ever, you know, had an image from Ironman in my head, and that, you know, was right around 2009 that I got into to triathlon. And so I literally spent, you know, hundreds of hours staring at this photo, and I thought, you know, you don't know if you're gonna win your last race, when it's gonna be. You don't know if you're gonna get injured, whatever. I said, now's the time. Let's pay homage to Craig right here. So I tried my very best to do my rendition of Craig's finish line from Kona 2009 as my sort of gratefulness to him for all the inspiration he has provided to me.
You know what I love is here you are, a guy who, you know, is normally going, okay, I'm way off the back in the swim, and you're swimming along going, I wonder if I took a wrong turn. I'm sort of leading the chase pack here. You know, like you're out doing a little backstroke.
Yeah.
Where is everybody? That,
yeah.
I bet you there was a little carryover from Island House where you had to swim so hard just to stay in the same zip code as those guys.
It was odd, yeah. Like the whole thing, how it went was, I mean, I was on some feed in the beginning, and
yep.
Then I sighted once, and I saw a gap had opened up. And then I was like, okay, come on, we got to close that gap. So I went around the guy, got onto the next set of feet, and then another gap opened up a little while. I went around, and I had to really work hard to bridge this next gap. And then we get to the two turn buoys, and then I'm starting to move my way up, actually. There's about five of us. And then we come around the turn buoys, and I feel like the guys are not swimming straight. So I'm like, all right, I'm just going to go. I'm going to swim straight towards that buoy. And then I'm swimming for a while. I'm like, there's no one around me. I'm like, am I, like, swimming the right way?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So, because I've never had this experience before, right? Because usually I'm behind these guys
yes.
who I'm swimming with. So usually I'm sighting them. This is what I realized. Usually I use them to guide me the
yeah.
way. And so I did a little backstroke turn and looked back. And, no, there were guys. They were just, you know, a couple, 2 meters back or something like that. And then I started thinking, I'm like, I wonder actually if I'm swimming like an hour five or something, like if I'm in the pack behind what I'm normally swimming. And then when we came up the stairs and I came out and I looked over and it was Pedro Gomez, who I've raced, you know, many, many times.
Yeah.
And I've never come out with him. Then I realized, I was like, oh, wow, I think I just had probably the best swim I've ever had. And what's hilarious is I think he had to take a double take at me because he's not used to seeing me. And then he said, wow, you had a good swim.
Yeah, because he's probably thinking, oh, my God, what happened to my swim? What am I doing back
yeah,
with this guy?
Maybe he was hoping that I had a good swim, and he didn't have a bad swim. I never thought about that.
So when you're you've had so much success at that 70.3 distance, and obviously you've won a number of Ironman races now, full distance races. But after the race, you decided you're going to step away from the full for a while?
I mean, I, unfortunately, my swim is still in the championship races is very, very different because you have a very, very strong front
yep.
swim pack. And as I learned, Malulaba was like the worst case possible scenario. And Kona definitely is not, never will be nearly as bad for multiple reasons. You know, yeah, it's the biggest race. You have the best, very best referees. And of course, there's more subjectivity because of the fact, or rather objectivity, because of the fact that the markers on the side of the road are spaced 40 meters or 40 feet apart. So the refs and the athletes are able to use those markers to gauge the draft zone.
Right.
So, you know, it's not as big of a problem, but regardless, you know, you need to be at least a decent swimmer to have any shot in Kona, because you need to be part of that bike pack.
You
need to be part of those dynamics at some point, you know. And so for me, and that's my goal, I want to win Kona one day. And so I know I can't do it with where my swim is at now, so I need to improve that swim in order to make that dream a reality. So I'm going to put the Ironman on the back burner for a little while. I'm certainly going to do 70.3s. I think they're great. I think preparing for them, it will get you in great Ironman shape. But that is going to be allow me to spend more time focusing on preparing for the Ironman, as well as, you know, I think it's just the conscious decision that I'm only doing 70.3s now, that is going to sort of say, okay, if you're only doing 70.3s, then you need to spend that time, that extra time, working on the swim. Either that's through actual swimming, some dry land stuff, and then for me, a big one is mobility and stretching type exercises, because I'm just very, very, you know, poor posture. Not great movement through the scapula and in those areas, and then also, you know, quite poor flexibility. So all areas that I'll work on.
So will you work with Jerry Rodriguez, Tower 26?
For sure. You know, of course, the remote coaching thing is tough and
it
probably
tough.
Not the greatest route for a weaker swimmer. So I'm also going to start, and this is one thing I learned at Island House, which was another great part about that race, because I got to connect with guys like Richard Murray, who wasn't a very good swimmer, and then, you know, he's one of the best now. He's doing very well in ITU. And a lot of these guys, their conclusion, they couldn't even believe that I swim by myself.
Yeah, like, you can't swim by yourself. You have to swim in a master's program.
As a weak swimmer, you don't get the privilege of swimming by yourself. You need to be swimming with other guys. And so I'm going to join a swim squad here and probably swim with them 4 or 5 swims a week, and then also have 2 or 3 race-specific swims, or rather open water-specific swims that Jerry writes for me. And then I've also vowed to go out to do at least a week-long training camp, a quarter, all year. So those are like the big things that I'll do to improve.
I remember when Greg Welch moved here to San Diego and his weakness was swimming, and he would just go to the master swim practice with you know, Mark Allen and all the top swimmers. And he just jumped in the fast lane, and they're like, mm-hmm. "Get out of here! You can't compete. You can't keep up with us." Yeah, but eventually he was able to. Like, he would get mm-hmm. dropped in every single workout, and eventually, you know, he ended up winning the Ironman, becoming one of the front pack guys. But you can't do it swimming on your own. You got to swim with a master's program.
That's pretty much what every guy at the Island House. All these guys are much better swimmers than myself. Said like one of Joe Malloy, great IQ,
yep.
top American at the Olympics. One of the observations he made is, whether you like it or not, you swim next to better swimmers, you will become more like them. Like,
yes.
Just out of the corner of your eye, you observe them. You start doing technique that is more like them, whether you like it or not. You put two guys side by side, they swim side by side every day. One guy who's got sort of a, you know, idiosyncratic type thing, you start to look like him. And then of course, Ben Hoffman also said another thing similar to Greg Welch's situation. He's like, you know, swimming at this master's group, he must have been swimming at in Boulder. He's like, you see Craig Alexander, you see so-and-so in two lanes over, and you know he's going to be making front pack in Kona. So if I'm not swimming with him, that means I'm not making front pack in Kona, and that's motivating. So, you know, obviously the component of the social component of swimming must be a lot larger than I had, at least, had given it credit in the past.
No question. It's really more so than riding a bike. You can, especially as a time trial guy, you can ride to your wattage, you can run the treadmill, but swimming is all about being with other guys. And from drafting on other swimmers and learning how to sit on somebody's feet to realizing the difference in techniques. It's a lot of times people look really great above the water or look really crappy above the water, but what's happening under the water is really what's important.
Absolutely. But I wouldn't even go, actually, interestingly, on the bike and the run. And I've done pretty much all of my bike run training solo for you know, five-plus years. But even those, I think, definitely have – you can. I wouldn't necessarily do all my training, you know, in a group-type setting, but absolutely on some hard sessions.
Yes.
I think, you know, limits you don't really know your limit until someone else takes you beyond your limit, and then you find out, wow, I did have something more. And so – you know, I wouldn't recommend doing that all the time on the bike and the run, but certainly every now and then that'll certainly help you go up a notch or two on the bike and the run too.
So your first ever Ironman was in 2010, Ironman Louisville, 10/14/31, and at that point it's sort of a, you know what, I decided I want to do an Ironman, and you know, mom and dad came down with you to Louisville. At that point you were dealing with substance abuse and turned your life around through this crazy sport of triathlon. Could you ever have imagined at that point when not that much earlier, you were dealing with the depths of depression and dealing with substance abuse and your parents were kind enough to stay on board and support you, that now, 6 years later, you are the fastest Ironman in history?
Absolutely not. Like, when I go and I reflect back on that race, I couldn't imagine going 1 second faster, let alone I went, you know, 2.5 hours faster.
So yeah.
I think it's just amazing. And this is one of the things that I love about Ironman, I love about endurance sport in general, is, you know, if you give yourself to it, it is impossible for it not to change you in every single way, shape, and form, physiologically, psychologically, every single way. It will change you. It'll make you better. I think it'll change you for the better. And so, you know, it certainly hasn't been an easy journey. It's been had lots of downs. It has lots of ups too. It's just a surreal experience. I'm just so grateful to be here, and this is just icing on the cake. To get my life back and to feel good about myself again and to get in some good shape, you know, that stuff is the end in itself. These external things are just, you know, icing on the cake.
So you sort of like what you see when you look in the mirror now.
I couldn't look at myself for about 2 years. I when I would brush my teeth, I would just look down at the floor. I couldn't look at myself in the mirror. And now, you know, I certainly am not looking down at the floor out of, you know, shame or anything like that. That's for certain.
So when you – I read during the run in Arizona, you talked about you needed to be ruthless on the run. That's really important, right? You can't ever take your foot off the accelerator.
Yeah, you know, that I like see motivation. You have to take motivation when it comes to you.
Yeah.
I have a new training advisor, David Tilbury Davis, and he said to me before the race, he said, "Be patient, be wise, be ruthless." And I'm like, ruthless. That's a word you don't
like
hear
that
too
word.
Often.
Yes.
I like that word. Yeah. And so I told Aaron that, and I said, you know, just remind me of that if I'm forgetting. But, you know, I repeated it over and over in my head through, you know, who knows how many hundred times throughout. And yeah, absolutely. It's as much as it is an endurance event and you have to have control, you also have to be ruthless. Absolutely.
So here you are on your way to breaking the world record, but right behind you is a guy, Brad McMahon, who's gone sub-8 before, and he's having a day for the ages as well. He's going 7:50. He's running 2:40. He's actually running 2 minutes faster than you in the marathon. So it's, on one hand, you're trying to break the record. Two, you're trying to win the race, right?
Yeah.
You know, I'm guessing you're getting some splits going, this guy's not going away. If you, like what happened in Kona, if you have one of those spells where you have to walk for a little bit, this guy's going to be all over you.
I mean, I raced Brent at Island House, and yes. I think I outran him on day one by like 3 seconds. But then on day two and three, he outran me by, you know, quite large margins. So I actually knew going into the race that I don't want to come off the bike with Brent. He's running very, very well right now. So I definitely, on the bike, tried to get some time on him out of fear, absolutely. And I knew, well, I didn't allow myself until probably 5 miles to start to say, okay, I think you got enough fat, because I thought he's running real well. And if I had to start walking right now, like, he's definitely still going to catch me. And so yeah, I mean, Brent's been a huge inspiration for me. And he went 7:46 earlier this year, actually.
Yes.
And so, you know, I think we're in one of those moments right now, at least in Canadian long distance, and I would imagine in Germany too, like, they've been in this moment for a long time, but in Canada right now, where, you know, we're sort of pushing each other to new levels, and I guess it speaks to the sort of social aspect yet again of this sport. You know, I saw what Brent did and has been doing in the sport, and I'm saying, well, if he can do it, I think I might be able to do it too. And so it's one of those kind of situations, I think.
So this year, the goal is obviously Chattanooga and getting that 70.3 world title that you've been wanting for a while. And then you're talking Island House. And it's going to be sort of fun for you to not have to be thinking about, oh, I got to go do a six-hour bike ride. I've got to go spend, you know, 5, 6, 7 hours training today.
For sure. I think in the long run, it'll actually be an asset, because, you know, I think you can only do so much of that sort of stuff. And it definitely starts to, you know, there's probably some science to back that it even changes you, because you start to lose some of that fast twitch, you know, muscles. And so I think in the end this will be a good decision and will pay dividends over the Ironman distance. So yeah, the big focus is going to be definitely just pushing the limits on the bike and the run, trying to get the 1 hour power and my threshold higher and higher and higher, and doing the VO2 max work and that sort of thing. And then spending, you know, a minimum of an hour and a half to 2 hours a day working on the swim, either through swimming or through, you know, that extracurricular kind of stuff.
And in terms of the indoor training, still doing a lot of indoor training. I remember last year you saying in Kona, the fact what you were missing in your indoor training was sort of that ambient light, just how bright it is out there. And this year you added that in your indoor setting. Obviously, it wouldn't have mattered, because you didn't feel like you had the long training in your legs. Will this year be indoor training primarily as well?
I still think the indoor training is, I mean, first of all, on the bike, the biggest component is I don't have many places to ride around here, so it's safer.
Yeah.
But it also is such a great reproducible environment. You know, I love that part of it. And I've also discovered the rollers recently, which I think are sort of overcome the movement aspect. You know, I think the stationary trainer is great, and I still use it a lot. But the rollers also help you to then combine, you know, those interval work with also having to handle the bike and ride a straight line and keep the body, you know, the core and all that thing engaged.
And focus, so, right? You can zone when you're on a trainer.
Huge. Yeah, absolutely. And so I definitely will still continue to do a ton of indoor cycling, for sure. Pretty much all my riding will be done indoors. The run, though, I think I definitely am going to go outside, and I did start to go outside more this year. I think you because there's really no course that is just straight out and backed on a super soft surface, like a treadmill. So I think you lose something when you're not making turns, you're not running on a hard surface. So, you know, over the winter, I'll probably do like 80 to 90% of my running indoors, but as the nicer weather comes back, I'll probably do more like 50-50 indoor-outdoor. So, but still, indoor training, I'm a big believer in, and I still will be utilizing.
Love it. Hey, Lionel, thank you so much for taking so much time. You're always such a class act. And having you break that world record, I think it speaks volumes to what life is all about. You overcome obstacles. You seek to not just improve yourself, but be the best you can be. And sometimes when you become the best you can be, you become the best in the world. I love that.
Sure. Well, thank you, Bob. I appreciate you having me on. Love the show.
Lionel Sanders has been our guest. Again, the splits, 53:45, 4:04:38, 2:42:31, 7:44:29. Oh, okay. Lionel, now, did Mom and Dad come down to Arizona?
Unfortunately not, but they definitely were tuning in all day from home on the Aaron had the Periscope going and all that fun stuff.
Love that. Ah, I bet you they are so excited.
Yeah, actually, my mom's sitting right in front of me reading your History of Kona book right now.
Oh, cool. Hopefully it doesn't put her to sleep.
No, she's wide awake.
And a lot of good photography in there. Lionel Sanders has been our guest. Again, we're brought to you by Tough Mind Triathlon Series, OSCA Wellness. Run Catalina.com. Our Catalina Marathon coming up on Saturday, March 11th, the 40th anniversary. Challenge Athletes Foundation. We've raised over $80 million to keep challenge athletes in the game of life through sport. Check us out on Babbittville.com, on iTunes. Subscribe to our newsletter, and as always, endurance lives here.